SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales at sbs.com.au.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandame Ngaya. I'm Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 29th of April, just like every Monday, we'll bring you current affairs stories from an Indigenous perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. Also in the program today, a conversation with Gadigal woman Kate Constantine, who has proudly represented Australia at the Milan Design Week 2024, offering a contemporary narrative of First Nations people's rich cultural legacy. On NITV Radio today, we also spoke with the Northern Territory Dance Company's Gary Lung about The Other Side of Me, his groundbreaking new musical, in which he shares a poignant new angle on stolen generations. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Bulletin, Victoria's Premier Jacinta Allan to make historic appearance at Indigenous Truth-Telling Inquiry. The organiser of a gender violence march accuses Anthony Albanese of lying about being invited to speak. And Australia's union head calls for a 9% wage increase for feminised industries. The Premier of Victoria, Jacinta Allan, is set to give evidence in a historic appearance before the state's Indigenous Truth-Telling Inquiry. Ms. Allan's participation in a public hearing of the Yurok Justice Commission marks the first time an Australian Premier will appear in a formal truth-telling inquiry. In the lead-up to her appearance, the Premier has reiterated her government's commitment to treaty negotiations. Yurok is Australia's first formal truth-telling inquiry and investigates past and present injustices against First Nations people in Victoria. The final hearing in a landmark case, class action about climate change led by Torres Strait Islander elders against the Commonwealth, begins in Cairns today. Uncle Pabai Pabai and Uncle Paul Kabai launched the federal court case in 2021, arguing that rising sea levels could make their communities Australia's first climate refugees. They claim the government owes a duty of care to Torres Strait Islanders to take reasonable steps to protect them from the harms caused by climate change. Mr. Kabai has reflected on the long journey to reach the final week of hearings and says he's proud of what they've achieved.
Give me the pleasure, like, to show the world what we want and what we have been battling through. So I think it's time now to have our voice put out on the table and let the government hear what the needs up was for Torres Strait, not only Torres Strait Islands, it's for all around the world who have been affected by the climate change.
The coroner inquest into the death of Heather Calgaret begins this Monday, April 29. Heather Calgaret died in custody in November 2021 after being found in a critical condition by her sister, Suzanne, at Dame Phyllis Frost Center Prison. Heather Calgaret was a proud Yamaji, Noongar, Wongai, and Pinjara woman. Labour Minister Tanya Plibersek says she's not surprised people are furious about the rates of violence against women across Australia and acknowledges all levels of government need to do better. An emergency meeting of Australian leaders has been convened for Wednesday to tackle the scourge of violence against women after tens of thousands of people marched throughout the nation. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who has called the issue a national crisis, appeared at the rally in Canberra on Sunday, where he was met with both boos and cheers. Ms. Plibersek has told Channel 7's Sunrise she understands people's frustration and acknowledged federal and state governments need to do more. But she said the culture of misogyny online also needs to be addressed as a contributing factor.
Society is trying to fix it on the one hand, and on the other hand, we've got the exact opposite force happening, working against us trying to improve things. So we need to look at what government's doing, what police are doing, what courts are doing, what emergency services are doing, but we also need to look at what is happening, particularly to young men online, that is supporting these misogynist attitudes.
Meanwhile, the organiser of yesterday's rally in Canberra protesting violence against women says the Prime Minister lied about not being permitted to speak at the event. Anthony Albanese told the march on Sunday he and Minister for Women, Kati Gallagher, had asked to speak at the event but were not allowed by the organisers. Footage of the rally shows Sarah Williams, one of the organisers, standing next to Mr. Albanese and saying, "That's a lie," because before breaking into tears. Later on Sunday, she posted a statement on social media again saying he had lied and spontaneously decided to speak only because he was being heckled. Ms. Williams said representatives from the Prime Minister's office had earlier made it clear he would march but not speak at the event. Anthony Albanese has not responded directly to those claims, instead telling Channel 9's Today show it was an emotional day and he wants to stay focused on the issue.
Well, what was important yesterday was that the organisers throughout the country deserve credit for organising these rallies. I was happy not to speak. I was happy to speak. It was about raising awareness of the issue, but a call to action by all governments. Quite clearly, we need to do more. It's not enough to just have empathy.
The head of Australia's union movement is advocating for a 9% rise for industries dominated by women, saying it's a matter of respect. Australian Council of Trade Union Secretary Sally McManus argues the work done in sectors like childcare is undervalued and underpaid because the majority of workers are women. She told ABC News workers in aged care, another female-dominated sector, have benefited from a 15% wage increase and it's now time to do the same in early childhood education and similar industries. Ms. McManus says there's no evidence wage rises for Australia's lowest paid workers increase inflation.
Actually, it goes to the level of respect, how much we respect important work that women do in our society, and one of them is in the early childhood education sector, and they have not got the pay they deserve. If you take someone who's qualified at their level and you take a job that's in an industry that's not dominated by women, they get paid less, and that's just really not on.
Overseas, Hamas says it's sending a delegation to Cairo for talks aimed at securing a ceasefire as mediators increase efforts to reach a deal before Israel attacks Rafah in Gaza's south. Senior officials have said they plan to discuss Israel's response to its latest ceasefire proposal, which Hamas received on Friday. Hamas is calling for a permanent end to the war and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. But Israel has only offered a temporary ceasefire to free around 130 hostages still in captivity and to allow more aid to be delivered. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people in London have taken to the streets demanding stronger action from the government to reach an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Protesters in London say they are frustrated by the silence surrounding the devastation and demand the government stops using taxpayer dollars to support Israel. One protester says he will continue showing up to send a strong message of support to the people of Gaza.
We need to give children of Gaza hope, not hatred. And it's about building bond across the globe, regardless of what religion, ethnicity you are, and know and send a strong message to the people of Gaza that we stand in solidarity with them and their children is our children. And send a strong message to government that's supplying arms to Israel that this will not stand. It's our money. We're the people that our money is being supplied to kill children, men, women, and destroying their home and their hospitals.
Back home, the Sydney bishop, who was stabbed during a sermon 2 weeks ago, has returned to the pulpit with a message for his attacker. Wearing a medical eye patch, Bishop Marie Emmanuel delivered an almost hour-long sermon to his congregation at Christ the Good Shepherd Church in Wakeley. Welcomed with a standing ovation, the bishop told his parishioners he forgives the teenager silent.
God is love, and the Lord Jesus, he taught us to love everyone without any differentiation. This young man who did this act almost 2 weeks ago, I say to you, my dear, you are my son. I will always pray for you. I'll always wish you nothing but the best. I forgive you. I love you. And I will always pray for you.
And to sport in the Women's A-League, Melbourne City coach Dario Vidosic has urged fans to pack out the stadium for the grand final between the team and Sydney FC in Melbourne next Saturday. City will face Sydney in seeking a record fifth A-League final, A-League Women's Championship after beating Newcastle 3-0 on Sunday and 6-0 on aggregate. Vidosic says he hopes there are healthy spectator numbers for the showdown.
I hope they do come out, like two excellent teams that are going at each other, the two best teams over the course of the season. They finished first and second, and we fought till the very last day to pip them at the post. It sets up for a great game, and if it was up to me, I'd let everyone come in for free and just fill the stadium and, you know, and let them catch that sort of fever. We have to thank the fans because I saw during the week that it's the highest attended women's sport in the country. So people have come out, there is interest, and hopefully we can just continue to make it grow.
And having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, sunny 36, Perth, also sunny 27, Adelaide, cloudy 20, Melbourne, showers 17, Hobart, possible shower 16, Albury-Wodonga, cloudy 21, Canberra, possible late shower 21, Wollongong, partly cloudy 25, Sydney, also partly cloudy and 27, Newcastle, much the same, 27, Brisbane, possible shower 26, Townsville, mostly sunny 29, Cairns, a shower or two 29, Alice Springs, sunny 26, Darwin, similar forecast 35, and the Torres Strait Islands, a cloudy day ahead and a top of 30 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam this Monday afternoon. Coming up next, we'll hear from Gadigal woman Kate Constantine, who has proudly represented Australia at the Milan Design Week 2024, offering a contemporary narrative of First Nations people's rich cultural legacy. After Milan, Kate Constantine's piece will continue its journey to the Paris Olympics. On NITV Radio today, we also explore The Other Side of Me, a groundbreaking new musical showing a poignant new angle on certain generations, written and choreographed by Larrakia man Gary Lang. But first, current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective, brought to us by NITV's NOLA program.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
coroner investigating the deaths of two teenage girls near Bourke in western New South Wales 36 years ago has found the original police investigation was deficient and impacted by racial bias. More than three decades after the tragic incident, the coroner has been able to provide the girls' families with answers that the police could not. And a warning, this story contains disturbing details of abuse. Ricky Kirby reports.
The families of cousins Mona Lisa and Jacinta Smith came to court for the start of the coronial inquest last November, hoping for closure. The teenagers were found dead beside a highway near a smashed ute in December 1987. Non-Indigenous man Alexander Ian Grant was found uninjured with the girls. He was charged with drink driving and interfering with a deceased body, but later acquitted of both charges and has since died. In her findings today, State Coroner Teresa O'Sullivan said, "I am well satisfied that the driver of the vehicle was Mr. Grant, and I am satisfied that there was some form of sexual interference." She went on to describe Grant's conduct as predatory and disgraceful. Addressing the initial police investigation, the coroner found it was wholly and in some respects inexplicably deficient. She added, "The uncomfortable truth is, had two white girls died in the same circumstances, I cannot conceive of there being such a manifestly deficient police investigation." In a statement, the families of Jacinta and Mona Lisa thanked the coroner for her findings but said while it provided some relief, they still won't be able to see anyone held accountable for the crimes or the police failings. Ricky Kirby, NITV News.
And if this story has raised issues for you or a loved one, you can get support from 13 Yearn. Musgrave Park in Mingin, Brisbane, has traditionally been a safe place for mob, but more than 50 people living in tents in the park have been relocated to hostels to make way for an upcoming festival. Dan Rennie reports.
Tents are being taken down and fences put up in Musgrave Park. For the second year in a row, rough sleepers have been told to vacate so that 50,000 people can fill the park.
Keep going!
The Panieri Greek Festival in May. Tent dwellers have been offered a month of temporary accommodation in hostels, but advocates say that it's not safe.
This typically can be violent, people are assaulted, people are robbed, there's a lot of drug use, there's a lot of social issues, mental health issues, substance abuse issues happening within that space.
The local community says more needs to be done to find sustainable, long-term housing for those sleeping rough.
Historically, Musgrave Park has been a place for refuge and camping. This is historically known and has been an important part of not only people finding a place to feel safe, especially if they're rough sleeping, but also a place for a congregation and meeting. That's why the First Nations Embassy is here.
The government says it's aware of the significant role Musgrave Park plays in the community, and the minister is promising to provide more housing.
Our team has been really focused on Musgrave Park because we know that that is where a lot of people gravitate to. And so that team on the ground has now helped over 520 people in that inner Brisbane area into accommodation. Some people who have been long-term rough sleepers into more permanent housing, which is really important.
It's unfortunate that we have to have a big commercial festival like Panieri to be the catalyst for housing vulnerable people. This is something that should be happening all year throughout the year, not just when there's media attention and attention from the community. People deserve housing.
The Greek community have been invited to participate in discussions.
If there is a solution to the situation where there will be people that are still in the park, then we actually have to have everyone on the table. And I think it is disappointing that as to date, they have refused to come to the table.
NITV have reached out to festival organisers for comment, with the Panieri group saying they have no say in what happens in the park and ultimately it's a council decision. In Musgrave Park, Dan Rennie, NITV News.
And First Nations women have made history at local government elections in far north Queensland. In the Torres Strait and Northern Peninsula areas, a record 26% of candidates who put their hands up for a seat on local councils were women. Many of them were inspired by a recent succession of women who have been elected to the top job of council mayor. Carly Willis reports.
The Torres Shire Council region celebrated the swearing-in of its second female mayor in 125 years. Most of the Torres Shire Council region is Kurrareg country, and Elsie Siriat is the first Kurrareg traditional owner to ever be elected as mayor.
I think it was something that was always instilled in me to become a leader in my community. And the opportunity came out 2024 for local government election, and it was a no-brainer for me to throw my hat in the ring.
Ms. Siriat is the youngest female ever elected, and some questioned if she was too young for the job. But she says elders and community members have assured her that's exactly what is needed.
New approach, new energy. You know, these are issues we've had for a very long time, but we're coming in young, we're coming in new, we're coming in fresh.
Regina Turner also ran for mayor, but was unsuccessful. She says she was inspired by the women who came before her.
When women get together, we call everybody together. It's like we have that kitchen table sit-down discussion, and we're very inclusive.
Michelle DeShong has been workshopping all things politics with women in the Torres Strait for 15 years.
For a long time, I guess, the structures don't change, so we've got to work the system in order to make it more accessible for women. And I think as a result of some of these workshops, we're seeing that that is working.
Ms. Turner says she won't hesitate to put her hand up a second time.
You know, that just gives you a good feeling in your heart, knowing that there are people out there who see us, who believe in us, and who feel that we can make a change.
Empowering women through democratic change. Kylie Willis, NITV News.
And that's all for our stories shared by Nola, NITV's program focusing on current affairs from an Indigenous perspective. We must now step aside, but stay with us, because when we come back, we'll be joined by Kate Constantine talking about her Techno Gym Bench showcasing First Nations art and culture at the Milan Design Week 2024 and the Paris Olympics.
You're with NITV Radio.
This year's Milan Design Week, Techno Gym celebrates its 40 years with the special exhibition Designed to Move, featuring 40 unique Techno Gym benches, one of the brand's iconic home wellness products designed by 40 different international designers and artists from all over the world. Representing Australia is Indigenous artist Kate Constantine, a proud Gadigal woman of the Eora Nation, who is reimagining the traditions of her people's Dutch painters and providing a modern narrative for all to better understand First Nations people as part of the fabric of Australia. And I'm glad to say Kate is on the line joining us to give us some insights into her participation in this exhibition representing Australia. Kate, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
How is Milan so far?
I didn't actually get to go to Milan this time. I'm here in sunny Byron Bay in my studio working away on an exhibition actually for Paris at the end of the year. But I have been getting many video calls and lots of photos and tagged in a lot of social media posts from people that I don't know in Milan.
Okay, you know, I was under the impression that you will be waking you up or calling in the middle of the night, but glad you're on the same, you know, in the same timeline almost, or I'm not waking you up. Or excellent, excellent. Now, let's go straight into this story of you representing Australia. How does it feel being, first of all, selected to represent Australia on the international stage?
Look, it's pretty wild. I'm very lucky that I do receive, you know, commissions to do some weird and wonderful things, both in Australia and overseas. But this is definitely one that was both an awesome experience, but a challenge. As a dot painter, I'm a large format contemporary Aboriginal dot painter, so I'm used to seeing things on quite a flat surface. to then receive this awesome bench in my regional workshop and go, wow, how am I going to do this? was a real challenge, but something that I really enjoyed. I was a little bit frightened. The list of artists were absolutely incredible. And I did think a couple of times, why did they pick me? but yeah, I was really, really happy to collaborate on the project. You know, looking at them, all of them together, like, they're spectacular. They're just so beautiful.
Now, I saw them and I wouldn't think of them as objects to use for anything, but just decoration, you know. When I saw the design, yeah. I thought, well, this would just be sitting somewhere where I would just be admiring it, not do some work out on it or anything.
No. There was one that just took my fancy that was amazing. One of the artists had created like a neon light installation inside the bench. Completely like impractical for working on, but I just love other people's creativity as well. It was such a such an honor, I suppose, and a privilege to be, you know, a part of a group of people that are that creative from all over the world, that, you know, we all tackled the project really differently. And I think that shows, you know, how broad and beautiful the international art scene is. And such a privilege being a black fella, such a privilege being an Aboriginal woman, chosen to represent Australia. You know, I was the only First Nations person out of all those people chosen to do a work, and that our work stacks up in that environment is, you know, something that makes me really proud.
No, it's unique. And can you tell us about the significance of dot painting in your culture and how you've incorporated that tradition into your design for the Technogym bench?
So dot painting, it can be a bit of a controversial topic about who should and shouldn't dot paint in terms of Aboriginal people. Dot painting has always been very much seen as coming from the central desert area, and it's, you know, home is an homage, if you like, is definitely there. I've been doing like quite a lot of research over the last sort of 7-8 years into what the styles of painting down the eastern seaboard, but particularly in Sydney, as I'm a Gadigal woman, what our styles would have been, because a lot of those things have been lost in that transition from our beautiful place as it was to, you know, colonial times. And only recently I've come across a couple of amazing documents that actually outline all of, or most of, the rock engravings and carvings from all over the Sydney Basin. A lot of those are actually dot painted, which lends me to marry that up also with research that I've done on adornment, so body adornment of mainly the people of the Eora Nation in the Sydney Basin area, and with a specific focus on my people, the Gadigal people. We also used a heap of dots. So both women and men for different ceremonies used quite a lot of dots and line work to paint up our bodies. So to say it's just a central desert practice, I think in now, our modern times, where we can actually kind of debunk that and say that, yes, there's certainly a huge amount of central desert painters that use it. But I think, you know, there's definitely now, for me, enough evidence that across the eastern seaboard, we were using line and dot quite a lot also. That said, I suppose my dot painting is really different. It's not traditional in any way, shape or form, but the dots themselves are. But the way I like to think of it is as an honouring, you know, like an homage to those traditional dot painters of our ancestry, and use it to imagine new contemporary and modern ways to use those dots.
Yeah.
And what stories to tell using them. That's the basis of my practice, is, you know, that honouring of, you know, past, present, and also seeing the future for our art. Nothing in life stays the same, which is probably both a blessing and a curse. Everything has to evolve. And just like modern contemporary art that isn't Aboriginal, you know, evolves over the centuries and with different movements of painters and artists, you know, I suppose my version or my brand of dot painting is a super contemporary one.
How does your design for the bench aim to educate and raise awareness about First Nations people and culture in Australia?
It's very difficult in one painting to answer all of the questions that need to be answered. But for me, I saw it as an opportunity to go really bright so that the bench was seen. It took up space, if you like, in people's minds, just like that amazing neon light sculpture I was talking about earlier, you know, something that drew attention. So I went with a series of mine that I do called the Kendone Loves Collection. And the reason it's called that is because I adore Kendone. He's not Aboriginal. He's an amazing Australian artist. He's well into his 80s. He had a huge successful career in the 1980s, but then also, again, you know, a big resurgence currently at the moment. But the reason I love him so much is he has pretty much predominantly only ever painted Sydney, which is, you know, my home country, Gadigal land. And he's painted Sydney in such a way that he really put us on the map. If you have a think back to, you know, I was an 80s child, I'm in my 40s. You think back to, you know, the 80s, everybody had a Kendone bedspread with the harbour on it, or a beach towel, or a T-shirt that said, you know, Australia or Sydney, Australia. And for me, I think that that's a really beautiful thing, that a man or a human being, you know, if we strip it back to its essence, a human being had such a huge connection to a place that it was the reverence of his artwork. And his colour moniker is huge. Like, he's so bright and bold, and he really does show off, you know, my place, my country, Sydney, in the most beautiful way. So, so I went with a Kendone Love series piece that I painted, and then I used all of the beautiful colours from our harbour and the topography of the land. Those paintings are always based like an aerial view looking from above, and they're the topography of my country, of my place, of my special places within my country. And that's what I wanted to share with the world. I wanted to share our beautiful place, the physicality of it, but also like the dreaming of it, the imagining of it, what it evokes in people's minds.
Yeah. So you just cover dot paintings, but you really, at the same time, really celebrate the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, I'm obviously biased, but because I'm a Gadigal woman, but seriously, we have like the best land, the best country, you know, in the world. Like, well, look at that beautiful harbour glistening in the sunlight, those, you know, beautiful rock escarpments. We've got beautiful beaches. We are so spoilt. And I think to celebrate that, we as a collective, we, like all humans, you know, and Sydney-siders, I think we forget. We get very stuck in our, you know, in our traffic, and, you know, you only see, you know, your route to and from work or to and from your apartment or to and from your house. I think we forget to really stop and enjoy country in its true and proper sense. That I love to paint that. I love to paint the movement and the stillness and the joy of looking at something really beautiful and knowing that you love it.
And that was the first part of my conversation with Gadigal woman and artist Kate Constantine. We'll bring you the second part of this conversation in an upcoming program. But also, you can find the full interview on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must now go to a break, and when we come back, Larakia man Gary Lang shares with us a poignant new angle on stolen generations told through his new musical, The Other Side of Me, premiering tomorrow at His Majesty's Theatre in Perth.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
You're listening to the radio of NITV.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
With The Other Side of Me, Gary Lang shares a poignant new angle on stolen generations and explores colonization's grey areas and its wide-ranging destructive impact for all involved. The musical will be performed at His Majesty's Theatre in Perth from the 30th of April to the 2nd of May. And I'm glad to say Gary Lang has just joined us on NITV Radio to give us more insights into his groundbreaking production. Gary, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
The Other Side of Me is a story about the stolen generations, a very complex and painful chapter in Australian history. What inspired you to tell this story through dance, and why this specific perspective of a young man adopted in the UK?
It was through a lady from England named Laura Fish. She contacted Kim Walker from NASA Dance College, and she said she had a story. She was a lady who was pen pals with this young gentleman. And she tried to think of it going into theatre, but it ended up becoming something in dance. But he said, look, this is not my story, but Gary Lang is in the Northern Territory. So she contacted us. That's how that came about. And it's interesting because taking on the story, it was a little bit a heavy subject, being stolen and taken away, you know, and it's a great story to tell, because it's actually an Australian story that needs to be told. And what has happened here, it's not to make people feel guilty about what's happened, but just still conversations need to be said. It's just not my only inspiration out of the story. I had people wanting to help. So I had one of my aunties that was Stolen Generation in Darwin. We tried to get in contact with families through Stolen Generation, but because we weren't family, we weren't able to contact them. But she said, it's best that you open it up and make it quite Australian-wide, because it happened to a lot of children, First Nations children in Australia. And I said, okay, we went with that. And then my nephew, who was a naughty boy, he told me was, what it was like to be in jail, and he actually inspired me, and the way he spoke, it informed the way I created the choreography.
And it's also a story about colonization, also exploring the grey areas of colonization. Can you elaborate on how your choreography explores these nuances in the other side?
When you talk about grey areas, the in-betweens that no one wants to talk about, there's no grey areas. There's black and white, you know, like this is what's happened, and it's about people not wanting to talk about it, but there is conversation. People are still talking about it, but it's hard. It's very, very hard because my work is not to make people feel guilty. It's just made people to be aware of what has happened.
Yeah.
Yes, and hopefully so things can change, you know, just one little thing. It might affect one person, might change their mind, the way they think about First Nations people in Australia. I don't know.
So your intention is not to make feel people guilty, but to tell a story. It's no grey area. Mm. It's the reality.
And it's a story of, it's not about the crime of what they did to go in jail as young men, him and his brother.
Yeah.
It's about, all right, I'll give you an example. Because they grew up in England and they become naughty boys as they grew up, in and out of detention centres, because of their criminal record, they couldn't get it. When they came out of jail, they couldn't leave England because they couldn't get a passport. So, and someone asked me, do you think their life would have been any different? And I said, no, probably not. But the one thing is that when they got out of jail, they could go home onto country. And this is where the story is about the man that we're doing it on. The oldest brother, he always wanted to know what it would be like, what's the other side of him, you know? It's like two sides of the same coin. He grew up white, but wanting to know the Indigenous side of him.
Yeah. Going back to the artistic side of it, mm-hmm. How does the use of two dancers represent the character's internal struggle? Because it says you use two characters in duet.
The two dancers will work through the mental anguish of being removed, the mental anguish of what it's like to be a First Nations person, you know, what it's like to be on country. You know, it's you know, going through their life. So that's two sides of the same coin. One is I have an Indigenous boy, man. He's the Indigenous side of him, and then there was another man that's non-Indigenous, but been adopted into my family up north, and he's the white side, growing up white, and the other person's the other side of what it was, his spirituality. But it goes through a period of being taken, up in my head, junkie, you know, that idea of what I don't know about what a junkie would look, you know, behave, what's going on in their head. And then it comes to a point of the dying process. It's about the spirit caring and taking him. It's time for him to leave this world and travel back home. And I think with the production, it's giving, hopefully so, in a contemporary form of ceremony, is giving him permission to travel back this way. Yeah. Or any First Nations person back to country, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the show explores themes of identity and belonging. What other stories do you hope to tell through your choreography in the future?
Normally with my work, I always say to people, don't come with preconceived ideas. Come and find the journey. Things will resonate within you. Things might go, oh, I don't understand that. It's uncomfortable. I don't know. It will close people off, or it will make people embrace what was happened.
It's an international collaboration. You mentioned it earlier. You work especially with Northumbria University. How did this partnership influence the development of the piece?
Well, that's where it started. The choreography actually started there, and it was during COVID, and I was meant to be there for 4 weeks, just ended up being there for just under 10 days, and then I had to fly back. So we couldn't finish it off, so we actually finished it off and presented it at the Darwin Festival last year.
Yeah. And Black Dance is a platform for First Nations artists.
Black Dance is what's really good. Through my own general manager and my producer for my show, Black Dance has come on and co-produced the show, and they've given us a platform to travel it around. They've taken the risk on a show that's just very new, but it needs to be seen around Australia, and that's where they've come in. And they're very important to First Nations choreographers, dancers. We need Black Dance.
So it's very, Australia. It's very important to have.
That's under the direction of Marinda Donnelly. Donnelly.
Going back to the show again, it's not just a one-man story, but a story that resonates with many. How do you hope this performance will affect audiences?
I think within the music and the lighting design, the dance itself, it might resonate. It might make people feel sad, want to embrace what's happened, or be fearful of what's happened. I really don't know. This is our first time Gary Lang NT Dance Company is touring, and I'm really glad because we're doing the West Coast first. So we're here in Margaret River, and then we go to Perth. We've got three shows in Perth. We go up to Karratha, then to Carnarvon, back to Perth, head up to Darwin for Garamalung Festival, and then down to Alice Springs. I think, you know, people will go, wow.
Yeah,
I think, I don't know what people's reactions are. I'm just putting on something that is worthwhile and people need to see.
Any plans to bring it to the East Coast in Melbourne, Sydney?
Hopefully Brisbane? So, next year, yeah.
It's
about other people taking the risk and wanting to come on board for that to happen.
What are some of the challenges and opportunities of creating dance pieces that deal with the historical trauma?
It's hard to explain about creating dance and trauma because I have to be very careful for my own dancers that portraying trauma. You know, I've got to think about their well-being too. It's just not what everybody else is, because these two men are dancing trauma. I've got to see how they go, you know, like working through it. I don't know. I just hope people, when they have trauma, feel strong enough and have the strength to talk to somebody or see somebody to help, you know, for that journey. It's finding the strength in themselves to go, this is not me anymore. This is what's happened. How do I grow from this?
Now, before I let you go back to rehearsals, because I know I've taken much of your time in a very busy schedule, any final thoughts or something we may have missed you'd like to bring to the attention of our listeners?
My things are for, if people are listening, if they ever come to my show, is come for the journey. Just come for the journey. You don't come with preconceived ideas. Just come, sit and find your story, because it could resonate with you or a family person you know or a friend that's happened to. So, yeah.
Gary Lang, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on NITV Radio today about your musical, The Other Side of Me. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
You're with NITV Radio.
That was Elder by Radical Sun. And with this song, we reach the end of today's program. Your program will be back on Wednesday and Friday with more news and stories from right across the country. I am Bertrand Dungandame, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.